walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal. Must be an animal. Come hear the animals. Talking animals. Talking animal.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Jamie Katz, who runs the only licensed private investigation agency in Florida that specializes in locating pets. So yes, she's a pet detective. Although based in Fort Lauderdale, she takes cases not only across Florida, but sometimes in other states too, depending on the laws of that state and the specifics of the case. We'll discuss her foray into becoming a pet PI, some particularly intriguing cases, how she often works with her own tracking dogs, that she's not only searching for cats and dogs, she'll describe her first ferret case, for example, how she typically collaborates with a client to bring home their missing pet, and how she has definite strategies for the most effective ways to do this work. She also provides a handful of tips to help prevent your animal from going missing in the first place. We'll hear all this and more in just a few moments when I play back my interview with PI Jamie Katz here on Talking Animals. First, we're going to hear an animal song of sorts. This one partly deals with a werewolf, which I think qualifies in my book, in the Talking Animals book, especially when the song in question is The Werewolf from Stranger to Stranger, the fantastic new album by Paul Simon. So indeed, this is The Werewolf, new music from Paul Simon on Talking Animals.
Milwaukee man led a fairly decent life, made a fairly decent living, had a fairly decent wife. She killed him, sushi knife. Now they're shopping for a fairly decent afterlife. The werewolf is coming. The fact is, most old bits are mixed reviews. Life is a lottery, a lot of people lose. And the winners, the grinners with money-colored eyes, eat all the nuggets, then they order extra fries. The werewolf is coming, extra fries. The werewolf is coming, you know. The werewolf's coming, the werewolf's coming. Yes, the werewolf is coming, Joe. And arrogance, a national debate. Put the fight in Vegas, that's a $1 billion game. Revenue, pay-per-view, should be pretty healthy. The usual deductions, then it all goes to the wealthy. Still, the world is coming. Yeah, the world's coming. I'm not complaining. It's the opposite, my friend. I know it's raining, but we're coming to the end of the rainbow. The lion and the spying through. Oh, you don't know me? Okay, I don't know you too. The world's coming. Werewolf's coming on. Oh, the werewolf's coming and the werewolf's coming. The werewolf is coming, Joe. I hear howls and prowling the hill, the werewolf's coming, Bill. You better stock up on water, canned goods off the shelves, and loot's on for the old folks, can't loot for themselves. The doorbell's ringing, could be the elves, but it's probably the werewolf. It's 11:45, and when it's midnight and the wolf bites, it's a full moon.
Yeah.
That was Paul Simon with The Werewolf from his new album, Stranger to Stranger. We're going to proceed from werewolves to pet detectives. That is Jamie Katz, who, as I mentioned at the top of the show, is a licensed private investigator in Florida who specializes in locating pets. Let's get to the interview and a conversation recorded recently. This is Jamie Katz on Talking Animals.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's not uncommon for me to start some of these interviews by asking the guest about their experiences with animals growing up. I'm thinking that's particularly relevant here just because my hunch is that you've been an animal lover from the time you were a little kid. Where did you grow up? What role did animals play in your family?
I grew up in Sharon, Massachusetts, and animals were everything to me. They were pets. They were friends, they were family, they were part of the holidays, they were part of the family.
And were there a lot of animals in the house growing up?
We had a Great Dane named Rex, and we had two cats at a time. I had three cats total, but two at a time.
I see. So that was part of the whole formative years where there was always one dog, two cats, no matter who they were.
Yes, definitely.
And when you say animals were everything to you and kind of described all the roles, I'm going to take a guess, too, that you were probably one of those kids known around the neighborhood as someone who tended to sick and injured animals.
Well, I would have been at that age, but growing up in Sharon, there weren't any stray animals. I never saw a stray animal until I moved to Baltimore.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah, we just didn't have animals that roamed in the town, or I didn't know of it. But I never had seen a stray animal or never seen an animal that didn't belong to somebody.
Interesting. Wow. Okay. All right. Well, I guess wrong on that one, but that's probably, had there been stray animals around, I probably would have guessed right that you would have been ones to, you know.
Oh, I would have, because as soon as I moved to Baltimore, they were just everywhere, and that's when I saw a stray animal, and I found out that not every animal had a home.
How old were you when you moved to Baltimore?
I was 15 when I was living in Baltimore.
So that kind of changed things a little bit in terms of the animal.
Completely.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Completely. Because I was confused. I didn't understand that. I thought the animals were part of your family. And then I moved to Baltimore, and it wasn't how it was in Sharon. It was completely different.
So what did that do to your understanding or appreciation of animals? Obviously, you loved them from the get-go, even when there was just the ones in the house. But how did it change things when you suddenly saw there was quite a few animals around, including some that were clearly homeless?
Well, I felt like I had to help. I felt like there was something that I needed to do to help these animals, whether it was, you know, finding them a home or just getting them off the street, getting them to a vet, just in general, just helping them and figure out what could be done to get them out of the predicament they were in.
So was that pretty much kind of your involvement with animals during your teen years then? Is just, hey,
yes,
whatever needs to be done, if somebody needs help here or a home there or something at the shelter.
Exactly. I would do anything I could to help. I mean, even if it was down to, you know, bathing somebody's dog because they had fleas and they didn't know what to do about it.
Yeah.
That I could do to help an animal is what I did.
And then what about as you moved into your 20s? Was there still kind of animal action of one kind or another then? Or how prominently did animals figure into those years?
Oh, it's never gone away. It's never
right.
Stopped. Animals have always been the biggest part of my life. So when I was in my 20s, I was working at animal hospitals as a vet tech. And then in the middle of my 20s, I realized that this is not what I wanted to do. I didn't want to be inside of an animal hospital. I wanted to be on the street actually helping the animals, hands-on.
So is that where you said, hey, one way to do that would be to become a private investigator that focuses on locating missing animals?
That actually didn't happen until May 2014 my friend Vito, her cat, went missing. And I went on Craigslist to see if somebody had found her. And she was 14 years old, never been outside before. And I saw an ad on Craigslist, and it was a post for private investigators who had tracking dogs. And it said that we find lost cats, dogs, and gerbils. And I got really excited, and I said, oh, I'm going to call these people, you know. At first, I never heard of anything like that, and I thought it sounded stupid. I said, dogs tracking cats and dogs? That's weird. So my next thought was to call them, and then I did that, and they never showed up. And we found Honey on the third day under the house next door. And from that point on, I had now a couple new things I had to figure out. I had to find out, you know, can dogs really find lost pets, because if they can, then this is what I'm going to do forever. And then the second problem I had was now I had to help all these people that, this company wasn't showing up and helping.
Sounds like that was a pivotal phone call. The lack of response, interestingly enough, was kind of the light bulb moment. Yeah.
Me and my friend Zia, we waited for 3 days for these people to show up, and they called every day, told us they were on their way every day, and we waited, and they never showed up. Imagine the thought of, this hero, so to speak, coming to save the day and find your animal. At least that's what I thought. And they didn't show up, and I mean, we were both crying. It was sad.
Disappointment, it sounds like the beginning of a new career was born.
Definitely was. Exactly what happened.
Well, let me let folks know this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Jamie Katz, a licensed private investigator specializing in reuniting lost, missing, and stolen pets with their families. So I guess in a sense, yes, she is a real-life pet detective. This conversation was recorded recently. How did things go from there? Once you said, hey, these people just aren't on the ball and they're not responding, and I personally have been through the disappointment side of that. What were the next steps then for you to say, hey, this is the world I want to step into and do it, obviously, differently?
Right. The next step was to find a company that I could work for and learn, and then, that's what I did. I had to make sure it was real, and it is, and I opened my own agency.
So how did you get the training then? I would think, at least, you can't just put a shingle out and say, okay, I'm a private eye and I can find cases.
Well, I was actually already a private investigator.
Oh.
An intern.
Okay.
Yeah, I had already started the career as a private investigator just because I knew that I wanted to. Investigations was a big part of my life too. I always want to know the answer to everything, and I always want to find out the truth.
Okay.
I've always been that way, and I'm awesome at finding people. I can find anybody. So I was really, that was the whole finding investigations and animals. My dream was to put those two together and make it a career. And when Zio's cat went missing, that was just the beginning of it. And then I found a company. I went and I worked with them, and then I opened my own agency about a year and a half later.
So the company you went to work for, were they a more general private eye firm that also did pet investigations, or were they strictly a pet PI firm?
Yeah, no, they did lost pets.
Okay. So, because, I don't know how many there are of those around. I mean, years and years ago, more than a decade ago, I would say, I interviewed Kat Albrecht, who I think in some ways is probably the...
Mrs. Pet Partnership. Yeah, she's still the queen of it and the godmother of it.
Yeah, no, she's really like a seminal figure. And even back then, it seemed like there was a few places people could train. And I think she was instrumental in trying to get a more standardized bit of training so that people who would do it in various parts of the country would have at least some universal techniques that would make them more effective.
Yeah, no, she's still out there. She's awesome.
That's cool. All right, so tell me about your very first case. Once you've trained, you've decided you want to do it, you've been at this firm, then you start your own firm. Tell me about your very first case on your own searching for an animal.
My first case is Clyde. Clyde was a poodle mix, or Lhasa mix. He went missing in Tamarack. Hold on, let me bring up the info so I want to actually be able to give you correct information. One sec. Yeah, I'm here. Sorry, I was just trying to get this. So I wanted to get the Clyde case. I can tell you about this.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I just thought we might have dropped it. Because, so far, the phone connection, I have to say, hasn't been great, but we at least mainly can understand it. But I thought we might have dropped the call altogether. So, okay.
Still here. So Clyde went missing on September 20th in Tamarack, Florida. And Clyde was a senior dog. He was a diabetic. And it took us 52 days to find him. And when we found him, we finally got him back. And the day after, he passed away. It was one of the most saddest. It was just horrible. It was, the owner, she was elderly. The dog was elderly. He went missing at about 10:30 at night. I guess the neighbors had fireworks going off, and he backed out of his harness. And that was it. And she didn't see him again. It was about a month, and then we had a sighting of somebody putting a small dog that looked like Clyde into a grocery bag on the side of, it was in Tamarack right by his house. I forget the actual street. And me and my dogs went there the following day, and my dog from the actual sighting where that was, I gave him a scent article. He went right to, there were two back doors right next to each other in the condo apartment very close by, and I went and I knocked on the door, and the guy opened it, and I told him what was going on, and he slammed it in my face. And so I called 911, and I asked him to come out there, and they came, and they talked to the two different people who lived there, And then within 24 hours, Clyde was surrendered to the shelter.
This obviously has a very sad ending right after you found Clyde. Was that just because Clyde was a senior dog to begin with, or was there something that happened during the time he was missing that kind of compromised his health?
He was a diabetic.
Right.
He had gone 52 days without his dog.
Okay. Oh, geez. Well, that's a rough way to get started.
Yeah, it was definitely a rough.
Yeah. So, Jamie, if I'm not mistaken, you're based in South Florida, Fort Lauderdale, to be more precise. How far beyond that area do you accept cases?
Oh, I take cases anywhere. There's certain cases that, as a private investigator, I cannot actually step into and work with the dog, but I can do pretty much anything over the phone. And a lot of my cases are over the phone as well.
Oh, okay. Now, so just to back up for a sec, so what would be the kind of cases that you would be limited in? Is that, like, based on geography or based on what your license indicates?
Some California, as you have to be a private investigator to search for a lost missing pet and actually get paid for it. So there are certain states, and Florida is one of them. In order to make a career of this and charge people, you do have to be a private investigator.
But you are a private investigator, so...
I am, in Florida.
I see. So what you're saying is anywhere in Florida you could investigate a case, but if you're crossing into another state, then because of the limitations of licensing maybe in that other state, you would not be permitted to...
There's only a few states. Not many of them.
Okay.
I can do anything over the phone, but I can't step onto, you know, I can't take the dogs and work in a case if I'm not a private investigator, if that's what the law says in that state.
So in California,
if I was going to have... you know, search dogs, I would have to be a private investigator in the state of California, or it would have to start in Florida, and it would have to be the reciprocity of that state to be able to go to there.
I see.
Mm-hmm.
And
it just depends on the laws.
And is that partly just for protection, just to make sure someone that's not just saying, hey, I'm a PI, but they're not, isn't doing stuff, but is there also, since we touched briefly on other people that do this kind of work, is there also an element of protecting people's territories, as it were, about where they would be based and doing their work and not necessarily having people come from outside that area or other states even to do work where they're based and doing their work?
I'm not 100% with the answer for that. I would think it would be more to regulate private investigators in this work. But at the same time, it's not popular enough that, you know, there's that many people who do it, you know.
Sure, I
gotcha.
That
to be. But I don't think it's because you're, you know, keeping people out of certain states. I don't think it's for that reason, but
Take me through, let's take a recent case that you found particularly interesting for one reason or another, and walk me through the key steps. Like, first of all, how does someone typically find you and contact you?
On Facebook, Craigslist, a lot of the people who contact me are referred off of Facebook posts of people lose their animals, they post on Facebook, and then somebody says, hey, call that person, call Jamie Cash.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Jamie Cash, and they'll tag me. And that's how a lot of my business comes in.
So social media referral sounds like the key source.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And let's see, a case recently that was a big deal. I did my first ferret case. I had my first ferret case.
A missing ferret?
Yeah.
Wow.
It was a very crazy case. So the ferret, the father had left the door open, and his name is Benjamin, and Benjamin scurried out the door, and nobody saw him. So they searched for hours in the house, thinking that, you know, he was hiding somewhere with their other ferret, Bella. And hours went by, and they came to the conclusion that he was not in the house. And a friend had posted on Facebook, and then a friend contacted her and said, hey, call P.I. Jamie Cass, maybe she can help. And so her name's Stephanie, and she called me, and I told her, I said, I've never worked a ferret case before. I said, but I'll definitely, you know, do anything I can to help you. And we actually ended up taking the other ferret that she had. And we hid her outside with a friend of them in a little kennel, and had my dog find them to make sure that my dogs could find the ferret. So it was kind of cool to be able to do that, because I never worked with a ferret case before. But we tracked Ben, and we did have scents in the neighborhood, and then we actually did have a trail away from where she lived going out to the main road about a fourth mile. And it did turn out that Benjamin was picked up, and it was the sign campaign that in the end got him back, but they took him to Atlanta, Georgia. So it took about a week before they could actually go, and, you know, we found the person who had him, and they drove to Atlanta, and they drove 10 hours, and they got Benjamin back.
And so when you were telling the story of how this worked and describing the dogs, kind of testing the dogs with the other ferret, first of all, I want to talk more in a sec just about the dogs, but was that designed to see, hey, they could find a ferret, but not necessarily do anything bad to the ferret, or what were you what were you evaluating at that point with the other ferret?
I just never searched for a ferret before, and I just wanted to make sure that, you know, I wasn't gonna take this person on a wild goose chase. See, that ferret, she'd already been through a lot, and I wanted to make sure that my dogs could be scent specific with ferrets. Has their own scent, but, you know, I did the same thing with a bird case, and I tracked the other bird first. We hid it in a little carrier, and then I had my dog find it, and they found each one. So I just, you know, I want to make sure before, if I'm not certain of something, I don't want to play games with people. So.
Right, I got you. So it's sort of a protocol to say, okay, if I've never done a bird before, or never done a ferret before, let's find another bird or another ferret as sort of an instant test case. And then once I know that the dogs are comfortable and can do that, then we can proceed with the main animal we're looking for.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I guess it's my protocol, you know?
Yeah.
It sounds like a good idea to me, and it worked both times, so.
Yeah. So tell me more about these dogs, how they came into your life, what kind of training they underwent, and you know, just how that works.
Fletcher and Gable, we train weekly here. I got them from the other company that I used to work with. And, you know, they're part of the family, and we all work together, we live together, and, they're amazing.
And what kind of dogs are these?
Fletcher is a little terrier mix, maybe a Minpin mix, and Gable is a Brittany Spaniel, rescue dogs. They're both from shelters.
I see. That's very cool. So it's not obviously breed specific in terms of what kind of dogs are particularly good at this. It's just a product more of their training or just specifics about that dog.
It's a happy, food motivated dog.
Okay.
I have four dogs total. Two of them are their sisters from Aruba that I had rescued years ago, and they're very shy, skittish dogs. They're the dogs that when it rains outside, they're under the bed. So those wouldn't be dogs that would be working dogs, because you need to have a dog that's always going to work no matter what the weather is, no matter how they're feeling, or, you know, all of that. So two of my dogs, definitely not working dogs, they're my personal dogs, and then I have the Fletcher and Gable. So it's about happy, motivated, and whether or not they want to do this work.
I gotcha. Well, again, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Jamie Katz, who runs the only private investigation agency in Florida that specializes in locating pets. And so, therefore, yes, she is a pet detective. This conversation was recorded recently. So, Jamie, so it sounds like, if I follow you, there's sort of two main ways that you might work on a given case, because you mentioned earlier that even in states where you might be prohibited from doing stuff, you can work the phones and sort of try to solve a case that way. And then it sounds like there's also the kind of case where you would be hands-on and dogs with you on the ground searching for those things. And what determines, other than geography in some cases, obviously, but are there cases that are, even in Florida, that you might just work by phone?
Definitely. It really depends on how long the animal's been missing and do we have any recent sightings. Because
right.
In Florida, I mean, anywhere really, but especially in Florida, it's really hard to get from point A to point B, and especially if you're doing a 2 or 4 hour case, you're not going to get that far because of, you have the canals, you have houses, you have yards, you have fences, you have cars, and you know how congested it is here, even just with traffic. So to be able to get from point A to point B, it takes so much longer than it would if you were, you know, in the middle of Oklahoma.
Right.
So the difference here is that you really want to be able to have a most recent sight-in before you go out with dogs, unless the dog just went missing, because you don't know how far that dog travels. And
sure.
If you want to be able to catch up to them, it's much better to be able to have a recent sighting, because my dogs will say yes or no to a sighting. So say, you know, Fluffy was at 5th and 6th Street. Somebody called in and said, I just saw your cat, or I just saw your dog, 5th and 6th Street. Well, then we can go there if we have 100% scent article, and I can give it to the dogs, and I can say, find that dog or find that cat. Start tracking, that's their dog or that's their cat. If they come back to me, it's not. So they're scent specific to the point where they're going to say yes or no on a sighting.
Sure.
So if we have the opportunity to be able to jump ahead and start, you know, at a most recent sighting, then that's where you want to be, because you want to get in front of that animal.
Right. Make your efforts more focused from
right.
the get-go. I got you. So I assume that, apart from maybe the ferret case, Benjamin, but I assume that generally if it's cats and dogs, when people contact you, is it usually after they've made significant efforts of their own, looking around the neighborhood, putting up flyers, going around, knocking on doors, whatever they might do? Or what usually precedes the efforts of the animal family in question before they contact
sure.
you?
Okay, so usually the people who contact me have already, you know, exhausted, you know, the options that they believe are out there, and they think that they have done everything that, you know, they can do, and they're right, because, you know, they've never dealt with this before. And, you know, I tell everybody, I say, I'm not trying to be rude, I say, but I can't go to your job and do it the way you do it. You know, I don't know how you do your job. So, yes, they've exhausted, you know, putting up flyers and, you know, talking to people and their social media campaign, and they need a little bit more guidance and focus on really how to move their case forward. So I can give you an example, actually.
Sure.
The last couple of days, I had a new cat case that came in. The cat's name is Sammy. Sammy went missing on June 6th at midnight, and she had a couple sightings in that time, and then she hired me 2 days ago. So it was day 19 of Sammy missing. She hired me day 19. We got Sammy back on day 20. So it was the sign campaign 100%, and she had already put 1,000 flyers up. 1,000. Still, yeah. So we did 60 signs. She put 60 of them up exactly the way that I mapped it out for her, and she had Sammy home in one day.
And was that strictly the product, the flyer, or the newly designed sort of strategy 100%. that you had recommended?
100%, yeah.
Yeah. So it sounds like because it sounds like she had really done quite a bit. If she's put up 1,000 flyers, I mean, she hasn't just put up six and said, "Hey, I'm not getting any action." I mean, she had done extensive flyering. So your part of your expertise in this case, for example, was yes, there's putting up flyers, and then there's putting up flyers based on a certain strategy.
So there's flyers and there's signs.
Okay.
Okay, the difference between a flyer and a sign is that you have to pull over to see what a flyer says. And a lot of people aren't going to pull over. I don't even pull over for flyers unless I see 20 of them, and I'm going to pull over and say, okay, let me see what this says. But you have to make it easy for somebody to call you. So they need to be driving 50, 60 miles an hour and be able to see your sign. That's the whole key, is make it impossible for anybody to come in or out of a certain mile radius of where your animal went missing and not know you have a missing animal and not know who they are. So if you can do that and you make it easy for somebody to be able to get your phone number, then you're going to make it easy to get a sight in or to get that information.
So the difference then, it sounds like, if I follow you, is between the 1,000 that she put up and what you recommended wasn't strictly location. It was the actual design and what was going to capture people's attention and get people to respond.
It's the location, it's the sign, and it's the expertise and the professional part of this. You know, you have to have a strategy. You have to make sense of what's going on, because if you can't make sense of the case, then you can't move forward. You can make sense of what's going on, and you can have a plan to gain awareness, then you're going to gain the information you're looking for. So it's definitely a combination of everything together,
right?
Not just one thing.
So in this case, Jamie, just to follow up on that then, how many locations for the sign that you recommended she use in place of the flyers that she had already put up 1,000 of? I mean, how many different locations were there? Or were they...
30.
There was 30 locations that were different, and not to mention the design of what was presented was different.
Well, you have to remember, when somebody puts up 1,000 flyers, or they say that they put up flyers, you know, they don't usually put them up in a strategy. Like, they don't have a strategy. They don't go on a computer and map out where every single sign goes. They're in a frantic state of mind. They're just, you know, stapling and taping and just doing whatever they can do, putting flyers up just to get them up and out to people.
Yeah.
So there is no strategy. There has to be a strategy that has to, you know, make sense so that you can do something to move forward.
And is the strategy that you recommended, like, let's stick with this case, based on how a cat, for example, typically would move if they've been out, and especially if they've been out in this case for 19 days, does that help determine, okay, here's then how I'm going to map out where the new signs should go, because this is where I think the patterns of movement are likely to include?
No, I actually, when I map out campaigns, I map them out based on how people travel.
Ah, okay. So it's less about the animal in that case.
At first. At first, it's less about, you know, you look at the area, you know, on the map, and you see what it looks like. And depending on the case, it can alter a little bit. But usually, I map out cases based on where people travel, because it doesn't matter, so to speak, of the animal, because they can't call us. It's the people who have to be able to see the animal to call us.
Right.
So I base it on people and how people travel. And usually people, you know, drive within a 5-mile radius to work. So with dogs, I'm going to make it a 5. And with cats, you know, it's going to be less.
So apart from following your instructions, like, again, making a sign that's a whole different ballgame than a flyer that many of us would probably put up on our own, especially in a frantic state, how collaborative otherwise does it tend to be with the family? Like, are you sort of guiding them through various steps and they're working kind of in tandem with you, or are you...
Oh, yeah. We're hand in hand. I walk them through this the whole way. So okay. What I do is I profile the case with them. I make them the sign. I send it to the store, they get my discount, and then I map it out for them, and then I hold their hands. So once they get all the signs up and they get their first sighting or they get their first phone call, they call me, and then we work together one-on-one over the phone. So I'm always available for my clients. If I can't answer, I will text you or call you back as soon as I possibly can, and that's how I work with every client that I have.
Perhaps an equally important question, maybe even the $64,000 question, is what steps can we animal people take to prevent a pet from ending up missing?
Sure. So I have a few different things that I've been, putting together for preventative. Is number one is going to be make sure you don't have any holes in your fences. And, make sure that you have a secure backyard if you're going to leave your animal outside, okay?
Okay.
And it's all about not hafting a hole, but fixing the hole, that's number one, is going to be backyard, because that's the number one way these animals get out and go missing, is because they were outside in the backyard.
Okay.
That's number one. The second one is definitely going to be, I tell everybody, get martingale collars. Martingale collars are, it is possible to back out, but it's not easy. So a typical collar, a dog backs out of, they pull out of it for whatever reason, and when the owner pulls and the dog pulls the opposite way, it comes right off, and then they're gone. And then they don't have their collar on, they don't have their tag, So that's another thing. I tell everybody, get martingale collars. You can get them at your local pet store.
And are you saying, again, the connection's not great. Are you saying Martindale?
Martingale.
Martingale, okay.
G as in Greg.
Okay.
Gale. Okay. Yeah, martingale.
Okay.
And they get the... The collars get smaller as you pull it. So it gets tighter. It doesn't, they can't back out.
Can't slip off. Yeah. Gotcha. Okay.
And let's see, microchips. Microchips are so important because, even if you have a roaming dog that's not going to let you catch them or, bring them to a shelter, well, God forbid if something did happen and you did find them deceased, you'd be able to scan them and you'd still get that information. So, microchips are important in so many ways. They reunite animals years and years later. I just actually got I saw something on Facebook about 2 weeks ago called Tracker. It's a TRACKR. It's a little GPS device that goes on like a little keychain. You put it on their neck, and it's awesome. I bought 5 of them for $86. I hook it up to the app on my phone, and each dog of mine has it, and I can map them a half an hour away. So if I'm in, say, Coral Springs, and my dog's at home, I can go on the phone and hit directions and take me to each one of my dogs. Yeah, so, I've only had it for a couple of weeks, but a couple of weeks, and so far, it's pretty awesome.
That's great.
I'm excited with that.
So there's always new technology along with just your basics, like a good collar and making sure the fence doesn't have holes, et cetera. So
yeah,
that's cool.
And then I got a couple more things, too, I wanted to.
Sure.
So, I always hear, I just bathed my dog. I didn't put the collar back on. Well, I don't take my dog's collars off. So I'm sure that some people aren't going to, want to do that, though. They want to take them off and wash them. So have duplicate collars that have the tag and everything on the collar in both of them, so that you take this off and then you put this one on as you wash your dog. Keep it on, because how dogs go crazy right after they have a bath? And I always hear, I just gave him a bath and he just took off. So they have two collars, switch them out or don't take them off. That's one thing.
Yeah, interesting.
And then baby gates in front of your front doors. I think that's an awesome idea. If you have a dog that bolts out your front door, and if you're going to have a pet sitter come over and you know that your dog bolts out your front door, just put a baby gate in front of it.
Mm.
Have a little baby gate that you can just open up and walk out yourself. It's not a big deal, and it's a great way to not have your dog be able to do that bolt real quick. Last preventative is 4th of July. Leave your dogs at home for 4th of July. Don't bring them with you. That's the biggest holiday of the year that animals go missing. The biggest time of year is 4th of July and a couple days after 4th of July, because you still have fireworks after.
Yeah.
And dogs do not like fireworks. Some of them don't mind, but generally they don't like them, and that's when animals go missing. So leave your dogs at home.
Yeah, well, this will of course air a little bit after 4th of July, but I think that probably holds true for like New Year's Eve, and at least periodically in Florida, it just seems like any excuse for people to light off fireworks and explosives of one kind or another, they do it. So let me ask you this one more thing, too. Let me let people know once again. again, that in case we're just tuning in, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss speaking with Jamie Katz, a licensed private investigator specializing in reuniting lost, missing, and stolen pets with their family. She's based in Florida, but can take cases definitely be all over Florida. She's in South Florida, but also can take cases at least by working and by phone, even well beyond that. So this conversation was recorded recently. So let me ask you this, sort of in the final moments here, Jamie, but what sort of differences are there in searching for a missing dog versus a missing cat?
I think that they're relatively the same. The only difference is the distance, in my eyes, is distance, and cats tend to roam rather than be with people. Dogs get picked up quicker. More dogs get picked up than cats. Cats usually are just roaming, and they just went a little bit too far usually.
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, many, many years ago, our beloved cat, Otis, who's since passed on, but he went missing. And now, not coincidentally, that was the last time we actually had an outdoor cat. But I felt like I learned a few things while looking for him. And one is, it seems like, at least from what I understand, is that when a cat goes missing, legitimately missing, like when no other weird or bad factors involved, they tend to be very close to their home. In fact, we eventually found him at a house like two streets over. He couldn't scale this big high wall, so he somehow got in there, obviously, originally. But prior to that, we had gone door to door. We had put out flyers. We had gone around calling his name. And so you think, if you don't have the expertise that you do, Jamie, that, well, God, now it's a few days, so he's probably gone that much further. But then we started looking around and researching, and it said, no, probably not. He probably hasn't gone that far. So then we kind of doubled back and looked where we already had looked. And I was calling out his name, just walking the streets, and I thought I heard him reply. But yeah, he was just, it was just several days later, and he was just two streets over.
I have an analogy I use with cats. It's kind of funny. I say that feral cats are like drug dealers, okay? So when people say, oh, but, you know, my cat wouldn't go far, but if your cat gets chased off by another cat, that's how they're going to get, you know, they're going to go a little bit further, because feral cats don't let new cats just come there and just hang out on their block, just like drug dealers. They chase them away. You have to get your own block. So that's my analogy with cats. But yeah, it's true. They do get chased off a little bit. And sometimes they can get lost. And that's a reason why a lot of times.
Well, so finally, because this is, I think, something that people just don't have reason to know anything about until they're on the wrong side of it. But can you address kind of the risks of placing a notice, say, on Craigslist or other places, social media, whatever, offering free dog or free cat to get home, and what unpleasant or sometimes evil things often result from that?
Really, you really have to do your due diligence with this, and really, you know, research who you're giving these animals to, because there's people out there who don't think the way that you do and don't feel the way that you do, and it doesn't matter to them that it was that, you know, it's an animal, that it's a living being. They will hurt them. It happens all the time. I would say, you know, don't just give animals away to anybody on any social media platform or any non-social media platform. If you're going to find a home for your animal or an animal, do your research and make sure that the person or the rescue or whoever, that they check out, that they've had animals before, that they kept, you know, vet records, or call the veterinarian that they said they went to, and make sure that there are, you know, that they're real people and that they are animal owners and that they want to take care of this animal and not for whatever, you know, other reasons that they have, that they're looking for animals.
Yeah. So. Well, a lot of times, of course, unfortunately, it ends up that some of these are into like research facilities or just, you mm-hmm. know, or just evil people or ending up with them and doing all kinds of bad stuff. So, yeah, absolutely essential.
Do your research, and just make sure that these people, that, you know, they are who they say they are.
Yeah. Very cool. Okay, Jamie, well, we've been speaking with Jamie Katz. Her firm is PI Jamie Katz, and not coincidentally, the website is PI Jamie Katz. It's KATZ, although it might, I'm sure 1,000 people have said, well, you know, does it sound like the feline cats? Yes, it does, but it's spelled differently. It's PI Jamie Katz, KATZ.com. And of course, she's also on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. So, Jamie, thanks so much for making the time to join us today on Talking Animals. I think we all have learned something about how to find our animals if they go missing, and how ideally to prevent them from going missing to begin with. So, thank you very much.
Awesome. It was awesome to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
It's time to step into the comedy corner. Making his Talking Animals debut, this is a Scottish comedian by the name of Daniel Sloss, with a piece derived from an experience visiting the Edinburgh Zoo. You don't hear this combination of factors every day, especially when I tell you I've decided to call the piece Gay Penguins, for reasons that I think will quickly become apparent. In today's comedy corner on Talking Animals.
I was in Edinburgh Zoo, and the reason I was in Edinburgh Zoo, and I was with the penguins. I was allowed to go in there and interact with the penguins, and the zookeeper person I was with was going around, and she was like, and this is where they eat, and this is where they sleep, and this is where they swim, and these are our two gay penguins. And I went, what? And she went, these are our two gay penguins, and I was like, one more time, please. She went, these are our two gay penguins. I was like, why did you show me anything else? Wasting my time with giraffes. Tell the rest of the animals to take the week off because this is the zoo now, okay? And the reason they are gay penguins is the greatest reason I've ever heard. As an audience, can you tell the difference between a male and female penguin? No, no, neither can most male penguins. And penguins mate for life. So what happens is, one penguin will be walking along and he'll drop his keys or something, I don't know, but he'll bend over. And one of the other ones that hasn't been paying attention will just be like, damn. And he'll run up and he'll have his way, and then he'll come back up and he'll start low-fiving all of his friends because penguins can't high-five. Yeah. And then the other penguin has to stand up and turn around and say, yeah, dude, it's Steve. What are you doing? And the first penguin's just like, ah, well, according to penguin law, together forever. Now, she tells me this story, and I am dying with laughter, right? I am happier than I've ever been, and it gets so much better, right? Turns out a couple of years ago at Edinburgh Zoo, it came to mink season, right, for the penguins and all the zookeepers. And all the straight penguins start having their sex, two gay penguins, they start having their sex, right? A couple of weeks later, all the female penguins start to lay their eggs. Two gay penguins, they didn't lay an egg. And they were confused by this. Because they've been doing what everyone else had been doing, let's be honest, probably more. Living for the weekend. And they had nothing to show for it. And in their confusion, they wandered around their enclosure until they found a rock that was slightly egg-shaped. And they just assumed that this was their egg. That's how it worked. So they put it on their feet, they waddled it back to the nest, where they then spent the next couple of weeks, every hour of every day, taking it in turns, sitting on this rock, waiting for it to hatch, which is obviously adorable, but only because they're penguins. If your friend turned up to your house with a stroller and a boulder, just... Karen, get off my lawn. Get off my lawn. This is unacceptable. Put the rock back. I know it's mine. I saw you pick it up. So the zookeepers were heartbroken because they knew what was going to happen. In a couple of weeks, all the female penguins' eggs were going to hatch to beautiful baby penguins. And the two gay penguins, their rock wasn't going to hatch because I'm not explaining that. But fortunately, in captivity, sometimes female penguins get a bit excited by all the penguins, all the male penguins there, and sometimes they have too many eggs. So the zookeepers took one of the extra eggs and they gave it to the gay penguin parents. And if you go to Edinburgh Zoo for whatever reason, you can ask any of the zookeepers, you can Google this story, there's at least one penguin in Edinburgh Zoo that has been raised by gay penguin parents. And it is no different from any other penguin except that it's slightly better dressed.
That was Daniel Sloss. We have a piece I've called Gay Penguins, taken from his most recent Conan appearance in February. Time now for another animal song, this one from our beloved Nico Case. It's Maybe Sparrow on Talking Animals.
Maybe Sparrow, you should wait. The hawks alight till morning. You never pass beyond the gate if you don't hear my warning. Notes are hung so effortless with the rise and fall of Sparrow's breast. It's a drowning dive and back to the chorus. La di da di da di da, la di da di da di da. Oh, my Sparrow, it's
late. The moonlight glanced off metal wings in a thunderstorm above the clouds. The engine hums, the sparrows phrase. Those who cannot hear the words, those who cannot hear the words, those who will not hear the words. La-di-da-di-da-di-da, la-di-da-di-da-di-da. Maybe sparrows.
That was Nico Case with Maybe Sparrow. Just ahead, coming up at 11 on WNF, it's Rob Lori and Radioactivity. Rolling into the noon hour, it constitutes a full 2 hours of interviews, phone calls, news, and more with contributions from members of the stellar WNF staff, including, of course, Everyday Ethics with Craig Kopp. Meanwhile, it's the prize for Name That Animal Tune, which we'll be doing by email today, by the way, as opposed to our normal phone calls. I'll be offering a Talking Animals t-shirt. Right now, it's time for animal news and announcements. The Humane Society of Pinellas is offering their Bark at the Ballpark this Saturday, July 9th at Bright House Field. The gates open at 5 p.m. for the entire family to enjoy a night of baseball, dogs, the four-legged kind, a best fan pet costume, contests early in the game, raffle baskets, doggy splash pools, and more. You can find out the skinny on that by going to humanepinellas.org. Ran short of time on last week's show, but in fact, the day of last week's show, the 29th, marked the one-year anniversary of when Cecil the Lion was shot with an arrow and then ruthlessly tracked while struggling in pain for approximately 40 hours before finally being killed on July 1st by Walter Palmer, the American dentist. So, a huge story then, and made some impact on airlines not being willing to ferry around trophy animals of this kind and other things, but just wanted to at least acknowledge a week late, but still, Cecil Lion and his passing, dreadful circumstances. Don't know if you're a watcher of that show called Zoo. It had its season's premiere last week. Again, they continue to, at least reportedly, use big cats, wolves, reindeer, horses, and buffalo in the filming of the series. So various organizations and people like yours truly have concerns about using those kinds of wildlife for entertainment, which can be difficult at best for the animals and sometimes dangerous for the cast and the crew. At this point, there's so much technology that can really replace any of those kind of wild animals on a set that there's it seems like hardly reason to continue to use the real McCoy. I mean, the Jungle Book feature film is one of many examples of using cutting-edge technology to bring wild animals onto the screen without wild animals being involved in the equation. And a slightly belated acknowledgement that the eight dolphins at the National Aquarium in Baltimore, been living in these concrete tanks, are soon to be moving to an outdoor marine mammal sanctuary in either Florida here or the Caribbean. I don't think that part has been quite decided yet, but this change comes amid more and more awareness of keeping dolphins in activity. And orcas in captivity, and just the incredible shortcomings and plight of those very smart, complicated, sophisticated animals in those settings. And this is about a week or so old, but just wanted to note that the New York Times did an interesting piece in the wake of some of the recent animal attacks with the unfortunate 2-year-old was dragged by the alligator at Disney World, and mountain lion attacked a Colorado young boy, 5-year-old, I think, boy. They've done a piece that looks at basic animals that one might encounter and what to do, what sort of space to give them, what sort of concerns there are specific to each animal. So you can find that. That was the New York Times. I think that was within the travel section, but you can just search for what to do when a wild animal attacks, I believe is the headline. And on a more whimsical note, again, meant to get to this last week too, anybody that, like me and others, likes capybaras had to be enchanted by the epic adventure of the capybaras in Toronto. Again, this is, for better or worse, another zoo story, but at Hyde Park Zoo, I think two capybaras that were later dubbed Bonnie and Clyde escaped, and they captured one, and then took a while to capture the other, and then the other one returned. But very cool irresistible animals, capybaras, not probably the best place for them to be living. We're partial to capybaras here at Talking Animals. So I think that's going to do it for this edition of the Animal News and Announcements for today. I'm Duncan Strauss. You're listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to name that animal tune. This is a giveaway, but please only participate if you haven't won something from WNF in the last 90 days. There'll be a prize, a Talking Animals t-shirt. The first person who emails, again, we're handling it today by email only, not by phone call. So please don't call. If you happen to know this correctly, then email right in to duncan@wmnf.org. The first person who does so will be the winner and will get themselves a Talking Animals t-shirt. So let's see if you can name this animal tune. I'm Talking Animals.
No regrets, coyote. We just come from such different sets of circumstance. I'm up all night in the studios and you're up early on your ranch. You'll be brushing out a broodmare's tail while the sun is ascending, and I'll just be getting home with my reel-to-reel. There's no comprehending just how close to the bone and the skin and the eyes and the lips you can get. Still feel so alone and still feel related, like stations in some relay. You're not a hit and run driver, no, no, racing away. You just picked up a hitcher, prisoner of the white lines on the freeway.
Can you name that animal tune? Again, if you can, email duncan@wmnf.org. And the first person who correctly does so will get themselves a fabulous Talking Animals t-shirt. Meanwhile, we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Rob Lori is up next with what amounts to 2 hours of radio activity. I'll be back next Wednesday, July 13th, with another edition of the show, so I hope you'll join me for that. I also hope you'll visit talkinganimals.net, where you can find archives of every single show we've ever broadcast in the 13-year history. iTunes podcasts are available as well. We also have links to the Talking Animals Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and more. Please like us on Facebook, the show, and or me personally. Follow us on Twitter. You can also subscribe to our newsletter to find out about our guests a couple of days beforehand, and other news, important news from the Talking Animals world. That's all found at talkinganimals.net. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thank you very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself, as usual. We're closing out today's show with an animal song. Today it's an instrumental version of an animal song, a Tom Waits song, to be more precise. This is Get Behind the Mule on WMNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weekiwachee, and beyond, Community Conscious Radio. Thanks so much for listening. Speak with you again next Wednesday at 10 a.m. on Talking Animals. Thanks.